It's Richard Mackey with the UBC Law History Project. The date is the 14th of June, 2013. I'm at the Vancouver Club with Blair Bailey from the class of 1944. We interviewed him on the 24th of May, so this is the second interview, and we're also here in the SFU room with Graham Zilm. So Blair, welcome back to the project and the interview. And in the last interview, we didn't quite get into your university years as an undergraduate. And I know you told me earlier that you had studied commerce, but can you talk a little bit about your career, your university, your career as a student at the university?
Well, I think most of us who were at the University of BC were people who were local people, mostly citizens of Vancouver and their families, and not many visitors from the outside. It was a small university, as you probably know, which was established as a university in place in 1925 in the territory known as the University Endowment Lands, owned by the provincial, owned and operated by the provincial government, and set aside chiefly for the establishment of the university buildings and for some residential purposes as well. 99-year leases being granted to those who would like to build houses there. The population of the university when I was there between 1941 and 1944 was generally around 2,400 students. And the faculties were limited to the Faculty of Arts, which is, as you probably know, a very general course of studies consisting of English literature, mathematics, physics, and the sciences in general. But it was not what they called applied science towards an actual practice in these things.
Yes.
There was a faculty of applied science which had to deal with engineering and agriculture and forestry and that sort of thing, applied. There was almost nothing else. And if you wanted to take journalism, for example, you had a choice of perhaps going to the nearest place would be Seattle at the University of Washington, or to the University of Alberta, and further a field in Canada, whose establishments were much older than ours. Law had to be taken in Alberta or Saskatchewan or Manitoba. I myself had some intentions of learning to be an architect, but my mathematics was so poor I hesitated to inflict myself on that particular enterprise. There was no music department as such. There was no medicine, although there were about 2 years of pre-med, as they called it, in the arts department. There was no dentistry or anything of that nature either. So you can understand that it was fairly constricted. The student body were generally from families around the area of the lower mainland. The practice was that these students lived generally at home and were fed and clothed by their families, and in many cases their fees were paid by their more affluent parents, But for the most part, students, in order to earn their fees, which were at that time, as I recall, about $125 a year, exclusive, of course, of books and all the other things that you need, transportation and so forth. It was general that students went, if they could, to work in the summer in the logging camps or factories or lumber yards or stores, various things that would pay them some money and invariably would pay for their fees, a little more than that.
Yes.
Few of them had automobiles, although the transportation between their residences, places of residence generally, was fairly sketchy. It was by streetcar, and although Vancouver and the Lower Mainland had a pretty advanced electrical transportation network, it was not very swift and not very direct. Many students' families, of course, had automobiles. Automobiles were quite common.
Yeah.
Even though they may not have been considered affordable, they were quite common. Their families would perhaps surrender the car once a week so that they could take themselves and their fellow students out to university, paying a dime to the owner for the gas. That was a system. The parking lot, these cars, lots of them for that time.
Where did you live at the time? Were you were your parents near the university?
Yes, they were. We lived at 3819 Southwest Marine Drive in a modest house. And like the houses around it, well, for the most part. Not like the other part of Southwest Marine Drive, which was considerably east, where you might say the affluent resided.
So was that Point Grey?
No, the east I'm talking about is that stretch of Marine Drive reaching west from Granville Street and the Marpole area.
Oh, right, oh, over there.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, that you get large houses that were built by people like the Rifle family and so on. And that was considered to be very nice and comparable to First Shaughnessy in terms of quality of housing, if you would put it that way. Anyway, to proceed,
why law? Why? But before that, you were in commerce.
Yes.
And was there one? Was there an influence? Was there a connection between commerce and law at that time?
You could, I think I could say there was, but in effect, I took commerce because there was not much choice of courses, and because, as I think I said in my monograph to you, there was some disdain for those who would just take arts and submit to the program that was afforded by the Faculty of Arts as being too impractical and not leading to an occupation that would give you a living. And that was the mindset of the time among people who were reasonably quite well off. Families often felt it was not necessary for the lad or the girl to attend the university because they weren't learning anything that would promote their ability to earn a living.
Yeah, so it was a practical focus.
Practical. Those courses were called good for the soul courses. But those who were not handy with math or with looking after animals and so on, the choices were certainly limited, and mine would have been limited if I had really wanted to be an architect. They tell me nowadays that architects don't need the math that we were instructed they needed, just the same as lawyers do not need the Latin we were told they needed to have. So I decided on this because it was an entree to business, and I suppose, and could be used in a variety of ways. The courses were interesting. There was accounting, which you need if you're going to be in a business of any kind, really, even if you're going to be a doctor. I liked the marketing course, things of that. I was fond of economics as a general subject, and economics was taught aplenty at that time, and the undergraduate scheme of things. Labor relations, marketing, as I mentioned. I found it was engaging and interesting. I was a bit of a dilettante, I have to admit, because I went into other things that were available for students on the campus. The campus was noted for carrying out that slogan that UBC bears, to a nest.
Yes.
Nobody, there was no official financing for extracurricular activities, as far as I know, say sports and that kind of thing. The clubs were there were clubs in existence which catered to people, for example, the Letters Club, which catered to people who were interested in literature, quite apart from the courses they were taking. They might be engineers. Don't look astonished, but they indeed were people of various walks of life and various backgrounds who were not taking literature, were not in the arts faculty, but found this as a very interesting thing that was in the university. And the Letters Club, for example, was guided by members from the faculty or from time to time. And they met at one another's houses, these clubs, very often, things like the Letters Club did. And they would give papers. They would be assigned papers to give on authors such as Shakespeare or Milton or whatever, and or the moderns, anything they wanted. And these papers were recorded, and they were stored and available to be seen today, I understand, from a friend of mine who was in the Letters Club. I was in the Letters Club, and I gave a paper. And I never finished the paper, unfortunately, so it's not on display. I regret that.
What was the paper on?
Sir Walter Scott and the Waverley novels. I later gave it to the Scottish Society here, but they didn't get a copy either.
Was that a family interest from your Scottish
Yes, it is, but it was one, it was sui generis. It's one I developed myself. Because my parents didn't emphasize it particularly. Being aware of a Scottish heritage, I would say contributed to it. And also the course in English literature given by Frederick Wood, which is then known as English 13, entitled The English Novel. So we had at least one Waverley novel to study, and I was rather intrigued by it and wanted to instruct myself further. And so I read it on the streetcar going to and fro in the summer jobs I had. I read others, that is, other than this one that was assigned. Yes, I regret not having filed the paper, but it was messy, and I was not much of a typist.
What was Wood like? That's Freddie Wood, as in the theater, isn't it?
Yes, he was called Freddie behind his back. Of course, they all are.
Yeah.
He was a very self-possessed and interested man, very much involved in his subject. That sounds like a sort of trite thing to say. They should all be that interested. He had quite a sense of humor. He fancied himself as being fairly au courant with things, you know, up to date.
Yes.
And he leased his lectures sometimes, the pleasure of the amusement of his students, laced his lectures with titles of popular songs and so on, as he might think were apposite to the situation, that sort of thing. Decorated them a bit. He was a maritimer. Used to say, "Don't get into politics. Anyone who's been in the Maritimes will tell you that." he was a friend of my Foyce family as well. He and his wife particularly. Although I didn't know that at the time, I was not married, and I just knew him as Professor Wood. He engaged himself by being with the Players Club by being on its advisory board, just as others would be on the advisory board of the Letters Club. He and Dorothy Doctor, she became Dr. Dorothy Somerset. Professor Garnet Sedgwick, Shakespearean expert, and a few others were on the advisory board of the Players Club of the University of British Columbia, which he largely established himself when the sketchy university at the what they call the shacks near the Vancouver General Hospital were studying alongside and with the approval of McGill. This is so far before my time, but I understand that McGill set examinations, and they did give credits for these courses that were taken down there, either by mail or by lecturers, but it was very, very slender.
Yes,
and it was not until they could move to West Point Grey and have the facilities of the auditorium that was built, I believe, in or about 1926, a fairly large wooden frame building, probably fire attractant, which contained a room for housing the members, or housing the activities, the non-stage activities of the members of the Players Club in what they called a green room, a traditional description of Players Clubs and even the performers on the public radio. Public television service. They refer to the green room in Seattle.
No, I've not heard of that.
So then they had the facility, very good stage facilities, lighting and so forth, sound and all the rest of it, in order to bring plays forward. And they did, many good plays by now. Just off the record, I'm just thinking. It's ridiculous, you know, but this is my memory. The Norwegian.
Ibsen?
Ibsen. It's ridiculous. I wouldn't have this trouble if I would. I'm just having to do it now.
Chekhov?
No, there's no Chekhov. There was, so many. Shaw. Austen, Jane Austen. Well, they weren't plays by hers, but they were adapted.
So you had a good repertoire of
Yes.
18th and 19th and 20th century.
Yes, Shakespeare, some Shakespeare, as I recall, very early on. The rake, you know, the man who was imprisoned in Switzerland for being a homosexual.
Oscar Wilde.
Of course. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I had to put it in those terms. And who else did we have? Oh, yes, there was this terrible player, composer. He was English, and he catered to little children. Robin and His Prayers. Come on, you know who I'm talking about.
I'd have to say Edward Lear, but I don't think that's who it is. Cater to Little Children, Barry?
Barry was Peter one. Yeah, I think we had Barry as well. Yes, we did. But it wasn't Barry, it was later. He was the epitome of upper class poems for upper class English children.
Hilaire Belloc.
No, he was a poet.
he was a playwright.
Was he?
This person who...
Oh, yes, he's a playwright. These are plays I'm talking about. These are plays that we put on. And I wouldn't have this trouble, I think, if I didn't have to... It's ridiculous.
Well, we don't need every name, but...
I have a joke about one of them, though, and he was the... So silly. We'll have to skip this for the moment.
That's okay.
But I've given you some, and there's just some.
Sure. When did you join the Players Club?
Well, I have to begin by saying that before going to university itself, you were permitted to take your freshman year at senior matriculation. At one of the high schools. Mm-hmm. And this was a very interesting thing because they gave you the same kind of curriculum that you would have in your freshman year at the university. Mm-hmm. But it was more extended. Mm-hmm. The term was longer. Mm-hmm. It didn't end in April, went on to June at the end, mm-hmm. from September the 1st. Pretty well.
Gee.
And the mathematics was rigorous. 2 hours of it every day, practically. No, I'm exaggerating. 80 minutes. Mm. Long enough for me. Mm. And you had to take all the courses that would have entitled you to take, or you have to take all the courses that would be a course for you to take at the university in the first year.
Oh.
Senior matriculation.
Yeah.
I took mine at a very splendid high school, McGee. It was located in Carisdale. And it was dated back to about 1914 or so. Mm. But it's a large building. It's been updated and so on for earthquake problems. And it was large, the population of the school was large, but the number of extracurricular activities for students was also large. Prior to that, I had gone to Prince of Wales High School, mm-hmm. which was much smaller, about 300 in the heart of Shaughnessy. And the staff were very adequate, but it was a rather... it was rather informal and not as complete as you would have had at a larger high school.
A friend of mine, Cole Harris, his father taught at McGee, Richard Harris. Does that name ring a bell?
Yes.
I think he taught geography.
Yes. Yes.
But I don't need it.
Yes. It does ring a bell.
That does.
Yeah. Yes. So Prince Will's quite different.
Yeah.
But McGee was really, I would say, the ideal high school. Hmm. And so I entered UBC Well, the microphones will prove something.
Working.
But I entered UBC in my sophomore year, which was the fall of 1941. And there I just, my first sophomore year was really more just looking around as to what I should do. And what I joined the Musical Society, which is a terrible mistake. My good friend said the Musical Society is the last place you should join if you had an appreciation of music. However, these are just opinions. When I saw the play by Sheridan, The Rivals, Sheridan, done by the Players Club, I decided that the Players Club was for me. And I went into it, and I enjoyed every bit of it. We had a lot of fun and a lot of self-education, because you had to know what you were doing, and you had to know what the plays were, and introduced to the club for the plays that we had in mind, such as The Rival, the Candida by Shaw. We had professional directors at work with us. And fortunately, the money that was needed to put on these plays, and money was needed, even though the sets were pretty elemental. Nevertheless, there was money needed, and it was provided by funds from the Alma Mater Society, who charged you something like $10 a term to be a member, and it was compulsory, as I recall. Whatever it was, and however they raised money, a lot of it was devoted to faculty, university, cultural and sports activities. The Musical Society was in receipt of the same sort of thing. And we went, the Players Club, in its early iterations, traveled the province, at least traveled much of the province, or part of the province, by rail and by steamer, to far off places such as Nanaimo, far off then, Victoria, Chilliwack, the Kootenays. After the term was over, and it was renowned for this cultural connection. They didn't have things like that in so many of these places, such as Oliver and so on.
What was there in Vancouver in the way of dramatic societies, or was that, was the Players Club it?
No, the Players Club was not it. What was predominant in Vancouver was the Little Theater. I don't think they called it a company or anything like that. It was called the Little Theater. And they had a theater, and it's still there, out in, near Venables Street, near you. It may be a movie theater now or something. It's not demolished, I don't think.
They've been renovating on Commercial Drive that's near Hastings. They've been renovating an old theater.
Yeah, I think that's the one.
Maybe that's the one.
Yeah. It has a long history. It goes back into the 1920s, if not before. And I think the Wood family were probably interested in a bit of that, too. There was some interchange of directors that we had from the Little Theater who came to us and back and forth. When I say directors, we regarded them as professionals, but the goodness knows there wasn't really any professional legitimate theater here as to speak of. But the Little Theater was renowned and did some very excellent things. I remember they did one of the plays by Steinbeck called doesn't matter, Steinbeck, and other things. So Vancouver was dependent upon traveling companies, and we had them right up through the time I was a boy and a young person. They came from New York and places like that, and They rented theaters to do this. One was the Empress Theater, which was situated on Hastings Street, just east of Main, in the block about east of Main, the Empress Theater. They did Barry's Peter Pan there. I was there when the performance took place one week. They also were able to perform in a renowned and historic theater that was built adjacent to the second hotel Vancouver at the corner of Georgia and Granville Street. That is, the hotel was, and just almost annexed to the hotel was this theater, which was called the Vancouver Theater, or the Vancouver Opera House. They had designs on opera, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. Yes. The CPR probably found that the renting it out to operas was not the most profitable thing, and it was later devoted to other things, and became known as the Vancouver Theater. It put on shows from other places, and also public events, public shows, and musical events. A theater of many of the arts, the performing arts. And it...
So with all this interest in drama, why commerce? I mean, didn't you ever feel like switching?
Well, I felt that I could... I felt that I could perhaps enable the theater to become economic.
That's a good answer.
I also thought that taking a commerce course with the things that embodied it wasn't just commerce. I had to have some general education as well. We had to have history and a language and so on. Had to have one language at least to get into it. I took French for several years, for example, beyond the required time, thinking that I would, as a Canadian, should have it, and that I might be able to, derive some economic benefit by having that facility, both in terms of dealing with the problems of Quebec and perhaps further abroad. It was a rather remote kind of expectation because you got the kind of French you got was instruction in literature more than in spoken French. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is the problem. And that was a problem for me and many others who are very good at the language in terms of reading and writing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of conversation, very difficult. A young woman who practically led the French class, in my French class at university, later endeavored to perfect her French by taking postgraduate work and so on in the hope that she would become fully proficient. But she told me, you know, that it was not easy and it really was not what she had expected to do. Mm. And others have said the same thing. Too bad. Mm. My French professor said to me one day, "Bailey, why are you taking French? Are you going to sell typewriters to them?" And maybe he was right. Maybe he was more correct than I thought he was. But that was one reason, yes. And the other reason was that I was interested in labor law. I had a left-leaning mind at the time. And I was not I will correct that. I was not interested in labor law as such, as a subject, because there was no such subject. But I was interested in how disputes with labor could be handled through the law and through knowledge of labor conditions and the existing labor legislation. That there had been so much labor strife in the province, and there had been so much poverty in the province in the years prior to my going to university, that I felt that There should be some way of dealing with these things in a fair way, and finding out more about labor unions and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I must say that it was a dilettante approach, rather, mm-hmm. I think, because the facilities for learning all that were really not there. Some were, and yeah. some were helpful. It's quite true. But I felt that you had to, if you were going to improve conditions, and if you were going to answer many of the allegations that were hurled at capitalists and other business people and professional people, you should know something about the economics of labor management, employment, and labor relations generally.
Mm-hmm.
You should know also, if you're going into business, you should know that if you're going into a business, you have some responsibility to your employees to see that they are protected from the economic costs associated with medical care mm-hmm. and old age and that kind of thing. In fact, one of our graduates in commerce did just that. As soon as he graduated, he pioneered the establishment of unions, of pensions
yeah.
in the province, in the some of the industries in the mm. province. His name was, hold the record.
We could, shall we turn it off for a minute?
Yes.
And I was also going to ask, were you at UBC at the time of the evacuation of the Japanese from
yes.
From the coast after Pearl
yes,
Harbor?
I was. We had very few Japanese in the school, I recall. Someone may be able to contradict that, but I don't remember any one person mm. who was of Japanese extraction mm. at that school. Not
at your high school or at university?
No. There was one at high school.
No.
It happened when I was at McGee. It would be December 1941, and I was at McGee High School, and there was a fellow called Shoji Suzuki, and he was the only one. And my friends didn't like him because he was Japanese.
Mm.
It was not nice.
Mm.
I felt sorry for him. He to gain friends, he bought a six-pack of Coca-Cola at lunch when we were eating our lunch on the playground and wanted to share it with us. Mm. And my pals didn't want to have anything to do with it. This is before Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
Just before. Mm. That's the only one I can remember. Mm. It's only an anecdote.
So by the time you got to UBC, they had all been...
Yes, they had been.
Yeah.
And what did I think about that?
Yeah.
Well, there were... It's a good question.
Mm.
It is a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
It embraces several things.
Mm.
One, there's the morality of it, of course. The Japanese here had not given any trouble to my knowledge.
Mm.
They had been very peaceable. They had schools for Japanese for their children, the same as the Chinese had. They had their headquarters were down in East Hastings,
mm-hmm.
Powell Street, rather.
Mm.
And so there was no evidence of anything like that, except
mm.
that I had noticed when I was on my bicycle at Pier BC, which I like to visit to look at the ships. This would be 1936. When Japan was suspect, all right, abroad, there were Japanese taking pictures, well-dressed Japanese. Mm. They were not tourists, you could tell that. You could just tell that.
Yeah.
They had very elaborate camera equipment in 1936, which looked very elaborate. Mm. And they were going at various places around that harbor, taking these pictures and getting into a car and then going further and then taking pictures of installations. And so I was a 13-year-old who went to the policeman around there and I said, "Did you see that?" And he was alarmed too. He would report it, son, he said.
Wow.
That's the only thing I can remember. Apart from that, the whole question of getting the Japanese and taking them away into the interior was abhorrent to me, but only because, but for the fact that security in this province of 600,000 people, maybe, I think that's my guess, it was just about that, not heavily populated for this vast territory, were exposed to an 80 million nation.
Yeah.
Not that far away if you go the big circle route. And who is going to protect us? And the question was, we know who is going to protect us. I know, because I remember we used to drive down to Washington and my father would say, as we passed Fort Lewis, there's where your protection is going to be coming from. And he was so right. So that this business of the United States having to come in here and occupy parts of the north and very much use Prince Rupert as a base was very, to my mind, very reassuring. Many people have criticized this. Many people have criticized the Mackenzie government or the Mackenzie King government for its lack of consideration for our sovereignty and on and on. I think that was in great disregard of our safety at that time, or lack of it.
Of course, there was a squirmel too in the with the,
oh,
the
well,
Canadian.
That was just a, I mean, I don't mean to be I don't want to dishonor our Navy, but it was a this is the Navy of a 10 million population country, and it wasn't. There were graving docks, there were cruisers. Yes, it would be assuredly it would be on board, but what would it do about a concerted Japanese attack?
That's right.
In one form or another, in the north, particularly where they could do that kind of thing. That's what the U.S. was afraid of course. I'm straying a little, but that is one of the reasons why I could justify the movement of, in view of the experience in Norway, when
the Quislings.
That's right. These were people who were often quite well situated within Norwegian society. Almost dating back, a friend of mine who's Swedish says, to the Hanseatic Leagues. You know, their background, long background. Very, very German oriented and could not be trusted. And it turned out they could not be trusted. They welcomed the Nazi forces. And so, to my mind, yes, this could be a threat to Japanese. People who lived in China at the time, in Manchuria, a lot of British people and so on, could see this coming. An uncle of mine, who was a sea captain, who went back and forth a great deal to the Orient, at one point getting back home on the Trans-Siberian, he was very interested in the situation. And I remember him sitting at the dinner table in 1932 and saying, the next war is going to be between Japan and the United States. I can see it coming. Well, that's just one observer, citizen observer. And so I felt, and I think others did, that this was timely, that they had to be removed. The caveat is this. In British Columbia, we took over, not only forced these people to go to a safe place, in rather questionable conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But we took over their property.
Mm.
And we started to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
By what right would you think we could do such a thing? Now, they weren't citizens. We don't know whether they were citizens. They were landed immigrants, you might say, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Some of them were born here, though.
Mm-hmm.
So were they citizens? Well, there's no such thing as a Canadian citizen at that time. He was a British subject. But that's perhaps just a momentary thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is that they were landed, they had property, and many of them probably could be described as British subjects, having been born here. And they and their property started to be sold and taken away from them, with no assurance that they ever get it back. Or that anything would be done at all by way of compensation.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is a... Now, this is my my bully pulpit. This, of course, is one of the great weaknesses of Canada, as I see it, constitutionally. There is no constitutional protection for property in Canada, apart from such statutes as will grant it in certain cases. Only statutes, but not a constitutional guarantee at all. And that really proved the whole thing, that they could do just that without compensation, as compared with sections 5 and 14 of the U.S. Constitution, which does protect property rights, guarantees no confiscation without due process of law, and then only when compensation is offered.
Hmm.
Not many Canadians realize this, but this was one of the things that occurred to me, perhaps not at this exact time, but I was astonished even so. I remember asking my father about this, why it was that they could take their property away, get them over there if you have to for security reasons, but do it in a proper fashion. Just show them that we're, you know, if everything is okay, they'll come back and they'll get what they have. In the U.S., they didn't do that. They compensated them. They treated them as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was controversy down there as to how they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was controversy down there as to how they could manage property that was in their name after they had left, and how they were cheated at times.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the principle was the property was theirs.
Mm-hmm. So here it was sort of kicking them when they're down. Or,
indeed.
Yeah.
Now, it has to be said, after all this harangue, that in the years following, commissions were formed, finally, to hear complaints from the Japanese who came back and to try to make some amends.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some awards given.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Somebody who would be more expert than that will tell you just how many and how much. But they had to fight for it. I mean, they really had to go to law for it.
Mm.
It wasn't considered a matter of right. It was considered, our moral obligation maybe is to do this.
Mm.
That's not good enough.
Well, it's still very interesting to get your first-hand recollection of that time.
Yeah.
It must also have been terrible with the... With the men in the armed forces and the air force, and were the papers full of stories of men missing in action and so on?
They certainly were.
Mm-hmm.
The archives of the newspapers would be your best repository of that, of course, and they certainly were. When the war was declared, of course, we were not prepared for this. Fortunately, in the eyes of many, the fact is that certain regiments were maintained. The Seaforth Highlanders, for example, the Duke of Connaught's own, all that kind of thing, now called the BC Regiment, the Westminster Regiment, all those were around and were ready and wanted to do what they could do.
Mm.
But on the other hand, there was no formality to this, and there was a great feeling of peace at any price among many people. Not only, of course, in Britain, unfortunately, but here. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the States, where, of course, at the time, it took Pearl Harbor to involve them in this conflict. Mm-hmm. But in 1939, it involved us. And it was imperative that that people should understand that they were in great danger. Now, at the university, and we'll go back to the university, Colonel Schramm, who was...
Schramm.
Yeah, Schramm. Yep. Gordon, I think it is, Gordon Schramm.
Yep.
You've heard of him.
Yes.
Yes. Well, he was very prominent in the university. Everywhere he could be, there was Gordon Schramm. He had organized the... he had organized the officer training corps. He had and was active in it. And I remember he held a big meeting in one of our larger meeting rooms, Applied Science 200, when he was telling the students that they were to do this and they were to do that. And he'd done. He said, you know, I have to tell you that things have not been easy to sustain a kind of military training force here, in view of the public's disdain for anything of that kind. He said, we even had to go down and practice drill in our civilian clothes and come back in our civilian clothes because we were attacked by opponents of anything to do with military activity. That's so strong was the feeling of it. And it stemmed, understandably, for the disastrous consequences of the First World War. We didn't want to have this happen again. Mm. Nobody did. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to even believe it could happen. And that was, of course, pretty quickly dissipated. Mm-hmm. But Canada, as you know, did not have conscription. We had what was known as a general enlistment for general service in Canada, but without having to serve overseas. And that was supposed to answer some of the criticism that we did not have an even and fair conscription for service anywhere. And I won't go into that at length at all because it was so terribly tearing. It put families against families and it put people against people on the legislature in Ottawa, the parliament in Ottawa was split on the matter. Quebec was against it. Quebec, of course, had always resented any national activity abroad, and this originated, I suspect, or they say it did anyway, from the the voluntary provision of forces in the Boer War in South Africa. Which, of course, Quebec and Sir Wilfrid Laurier, the then Prime Minister, opposed because it was not our affair at all. And the circumstances of that war were really, well, if you examine them, again, it's a matter of opinion, would not have justified our participating with Britain in that. And so Quebec was very much against that. They're also very much in sympathy with the Riel, Louis Riel, and the people in Manitoba, who were claimed to be displaced by settlement in Manitoba in 1870, when Manitoba joined Confederation. We are straying.
Not at all. No, this is so there was an OTC,
OTC.
An officer training corps, and Schramm was the...
He was the man.
Right.
And he was also in charge of... there's a name for this, but it was for adult training and adult education and that kind of thing in the university, as well as the sciences. He was the big man in the applied science department, chemistry and physics, all of that was his egg. And he was considered very dominating, but on the other hand, he was considered very capable. And various fellows joined up and were trained and went to proper training after that. It was a matter of complaint, though, also, among people who had, particularly among those whose sons and daughters had been sent overseas and joined up, that Canada's universities were still running the way they did.
Mm.
I have to say that. No. There was no sense that anyone had to join up. Mm-hmm. The draft didn't include, as far as I know anyway, people who were in, studying at the university. I was called up twice.
Mm.
And I had to go to Little Mountain and be examined. And I was rejected because of my eyesight, which was, I mean, I was a pop bottle. I'm at. And I would say to them, look, I go to the university. Here's my chance. Here's your chance. I can drive a truck. I can drive a car with my glasses on. I can go to a desk and do something anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. You know, why? I didn't want to join the army, but
yeah.
I wanted, you know, I'd rather have them pick something nice than just me being trucked away somewhere.
Mm.
But that wasn't going to happen anyway.
Mm.
And the universities in Canada were like this in the sense that, I have to say, we carried on our activities. We had our parties, black tie, and it was all in our cars. And it was all very the way it was.
Were there fraternities active at that time?
Oh, yes.
No. Were you in one?
No, I couldn't afford one. And I didn't want one. I thought they were discriminatory. You can see, left wing.
Yes. Why? Where did you get your original left wing tendencies?
From the conditions of the country during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
That was where I got them.
There was, of course, Vancouver was the site of the occupation of the post office.
Oh yes, and the riots at Victory Square, mm-hmm. and the need for Jerry McGeer, the mayor at the time, to read the Riot Act, mm-hmm. and the army was out, and these fellows were not treated well. I mean, I don't think they were. Mm-hmm. I think everybody who had been alive at that time probably now would agree.
Mm-hmm.
They had no employment, and they were given a chance to go into the woods and do God knows what for 25 cents a day, something like that.
In the relief camps.
In the relief camps.
Yeah.
And so bad was the situation. A lot of these people had families.
Mm-hmm.
We knew a family. In fact, this man was a lawyer, and. He had been a lawyer in Saskatchewan, but had been driven out of that desert in hard times. And he got a government job for a while, and then he was let out of that. And he was a very clever man in many ways, not just the law, but the technology and so on.
So did any one experience kind of radicalize you or politicize you, as they say now? or was it the general tenor of the Depression?
No, the general tenor.
Yeah.
My friends were all well off. My friends and the friends of my family were well off. My friends at the university were very well looked after, and their families were well known here. I had the chance of knowing some very influential people. I'm not boasting about that. I just, if you're asking this question, mind you, that very thing could have radicalized somebody. Why did they have so much, and why do they others not have so much?
Mm-hmm.
That could radicalize you, all right, and I dare say it did. But most of the people I knew were sympathetic, were aware of the problem, didn't feel they could do much about it, and. These were well-known, well-educated, well-financed people.
Mm-hmm.
That was my background.
Mm-hmm.
It was not my family background. It was more modest. But my parents knew a lot of these other people, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that didn't do it. Well, no, what it did was people coming to the door in the middle 1930s, coming off that tramway that I told you about, and just feeling that they were in the suburbs and they could ask for shelter or food. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. And if you had any sense or any sensibility, you gave them what you could. You didn't want to let them into your house because you didn't know who they were. Mm-hmm. So there was what did it.
Yeah.
And also, and I think I told you this, at that time, we traveled a fair amount by car, and we went through Washington and Oregon and Northern California, and we saw what the Works Project Administration of FDR was accomplishing. Mm-hmm. That these people appeared to be well clothed, they appeared to be well occupied, they appeared to have decent living conditions, mm-hmm. and they appeared to be endowed with some sense of hope that was not present in Canada. Mm-hmm. And that can be explained by the fact that this was not a well-off country at the time, mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. Not like the States. But it was pretty bad there. I told you about an early partner of mine who was from the States. He had joined the Canadian Army. He was a captain of the Canadian Army. And he also was unemployed. Probably why he joined the Canadian Army. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it was. But he had had an appointment to some god-awful place like the Ozarks, mm. and no employment down there. And he saw what had happened. They were barefoot, and they were clothed and shoon, given shoes and food, all that. That didn't happen here, according to my knowledge. Mm. Now, mind you, I wasn't next door to these things. I'm mm-hmm. speaking of what I read and heard talk about. Mm-hmm. I can only, there's some of this has to be hearsay, mm-hmm. but some of it was observed, mm-hmm. and there you are.
So at UBC in the war, was there a sense of, was patriotism more important than politics, radical politics, and how did it?
No, I don't think that I just don't have the impression that that radical politics, or much in the way of politics, was in existence at mm. the time at the university.
Mm.
That's not to say society, but
so it was fairly conservative.
Fairly conservative.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, as you might have already guessed, was I've already said that the population of the university was largely from people in the lower Vancouver area that were able to feed and clothe these people at home and probably subvent them in various ways because they were well off.
Yeah.
And they were almost sort of lifted from the, I'm using this word advisedly, lifted from the better high schools. The better high schools is ridiculous. Some of our best high schools were in the East End.
Mm-hmm.
But they came from the McGee, the Prince of Wales, the Carisdale, Kitsilano, mm-hmm. Dunbar area, and the East End too, mm-hmm. to the extent they could afford that, because many of their families were on relief themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployed or underpaid in some mm-hmm. damn job mm-hmm. that wasn't worth anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the result was that these kids were from preferred backgrounds, and myself included. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And for law school, was there any one influence on you that made you go into law? One person, or was that a general?
How did that happen? It was a continuum of what I've already said, mm-hmm. that the education in the Commerce Department was only a department. It wasn't a faculty either. Mm-hmm. It was. I'm not criticizing it because the head of the department did what he could and did it well. And he, we also had exposure to good professors in economics and so on.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that it was a continuum of going into law was a continuum of it's important now to learn the law as it applies to labor, as it applies to capitalism, and so on and so forth. That's what influenced me as a young person.
And did you need a BA degree at that time, or could you transfer after a couple of years of commerce into law? Of course, it was not yet a law school.
No, you could, but it would be difficult. Mm-hmm. I could become a 5-year law student, mm-hmm. but if I had a degree, I would be a 3-year law student.
Right.
And I didn't think the need for that. It was hard to plan, Richard, because there was no other alternative but to go to this law school, or at least undergo the expense of going to other ones in the East. Mm-hmm. I didn't know people who went back to McGill and Dalhousie the way they do these days.
Mm-hmm. So you did get a BCom?
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
And then you went...
And then I was admitted to the Law Society.
These days we go, when you go to study law, you go up to UBC, like Graham has. But in those days, it seems you came downtown.
No. Oh, no. Oh, you mean to law? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes.
In the first year of law, which I had, it was exclusively downtown. Mm. The lectures were held in courtrooms, or they were held in law offices, law libraries, the larger firms, that kind of thing, and by judges. And I've explained to you in my memo.
Your memo, yes.
What they did and who they were, pretty well, as far as I could recall. Mm-hmm. And yes, they were. That first year was a good example of what was transpiring right along. And then when 1945 came, I wrote my first year exams in the Odd Fellows Lodge. Isn't that interesting? It's still there. It's in the corner of Pender and Richard. I think Pender and Richard. In any event, it was changed as I had explained. Some of the courses were taken at the university, and some of our courses were taken downtown.
Could you describe your daily routine, say, as a law student in Vancouver Law School? Would you get you lived at home still?
Yes.
Southwest Marine Drive.
Yes, it was a long journey by the number 14 streetcar down Dunbar, north on Dunbar, east on Broadway, north on Granville, until you got to Granville and Pender Street, and the offices were in that building, the Royal Trust Building, and it had been built in 1910, and had been the home of the London Trusts. And then it was taken over by the Royal Trust. Our office was on the 6th floor. The elevators were creaky. And the building, to a young person then, seemed awfully old. Mm. And yet it was only 30 years old. Surprising, isn't it?
Now, was this with...
The Davis Hosea Marshall.
Right.
Yeah.
Davis Hosea Marshall.
So, historic firm.
So by this time you're... So Artling is the same thing as is actually part of the law school experience. You've explained this in your memo, but so you were there with the firm for the whole length of the time it took to qualify.
Yes, except for 2 months when I left in July of 1947, when I had already served over 3 years. My articles hadn't been properly registered. It was just a slip on the part of my principal. It's not a, not, I thought it was a big deal then. It certainly isn't really. But I had a job that I had to go to. I could not really justify staying at this. They had raised my wages to $45 a month, but I had a job that was going to pay me to learn this new thing as well. By a lawyer, I had my article shifted to Major Mulhern, and in October I was called, and by that time I was established in the insurance claims industry.
And could we go through that list of some names,
yeah,
of?
You don't want me to tell you my day.
Oh, I do, but I should ask. Graham, I should just check the time, because we've got to...
20 past three.
We're okay for half an hour.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. Well, yes, tell me about your day. That would be
If you want to continue this at my house, I guess you could.
Well, we, yeah.
It might be, the place is in a terrible mess.
Let's do it. Well, not today, of course, but yes, let's do it.
If we have to.
We'll get as far as we can today, and then we'll do another one.
Yeah. It boggles me. Surely you're not going to do this with all your witnesses.
Well, we're as long as the material, the information is...
You're going to wait.
...is good, I think we're...
All right. The day. All right, I'll try and hustle that through. It's not remarkable. I had my own desk and my own telephone. Hmm. That was something to start. Mm-hmm. And I had a stenographer, as they called them in those days, assigned to me. And I was asked to run a collection department for one of the leading department stores to collect accounts, to browbeat people to pay their bills. I called them threatening letters. That was the job number one.
Yeah.
And, I could dictate the letter to the stenographer. Imagine. I'd never done such a thing before. And so the time went for that and other things and part things. A lot of it had to do with filing things at the court registry. I would take up documents to file them in the registry. Do you think that was instructive? Yes, it was. Because you knew, if you were interested at all, you were going to read this document. And you want to know what it was all about and why, even if your principal didn't have the time to tell you before you went, which he often didn't, of course, most often didn't. And you went to the court registry and you filed, say, a writ to begin an action, and a statement of claim subsequently to outline the details of your action. And then you started the ball rolling with those documents towards a trial, if a trial eventually would occur. And then similarly, if we were served with a process, you would do the same with a statement of defense and file it in the court registry. And this way, you would see the process starting. And you would learn to know who was in the court registry and what they were all about. Some of them were very nice people, but if you're making a mistake or something like that, they give you some guidance. And then you come back to the office, maybe having saved 10 cents for a cup of coffee on the way, and met fellow disgruntled students. And then something else would be given you to do. Maybe you would be asked to draft a document, a simple document of one kind or another. Maybe you would be asked to assist counsel who had been hired from the outside, who was going to the police court to defend a poor soul. This is something that Davis and Company in those days didn't do, but they fended it off to somebody else. Well, you could go with that somebody else and do that. You would be given a lot of research to do on commercial matters. A lot of looking up.
So it was a purely practical experience?
Yes, in the office.
Yeah.
Of course that would be.
And you get a profession out of it at the same time.
Yes.
How wonderful.
Yes. I think it is a good system. Mm-hmm. If it's properly, if it's responsibly carried out, I think in some cases it probably was not. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know that according to what my friends had said, some of them, that they were taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. I felt that my principals could have done more in terms of explaining things, mm-hmm. but the problem is they were awfully busy. This mm-hmm. is always the problem about the articling system, of mm-hmm. course, for 3 years. But you do learn, I think, a little more of how to handle disputes, how to be with people, how to behave yourself.
You learn the administrative machinery.
You have the feeling more.
The structure.
The structure. Rather than just 1 year of articles as they have today. I think one result of the changes from the old system was the business of the Law Society having to undertake certain courses, explanatory courses, subsequent courses, supplementary courses in, say, wills and estates. A partner of mine who was very expert in that said to me, deplored what was happening. He said, you know, they don't teach wills and estates out in the university now. He said, they don't. Hmm. He said, well, this is absolutely elementary. They're now supposed to learn it by some kind of extra course given by the Law Society. Hmm. The university often regards itself, and this is more hearsay than my own personal knowledge, Richard. Mm. But it is that they take a very lofty approach to the teaching of law. It's more philosophical, you see, mm. and has to have the breadth of the niceties, the history.
The theoretical.
Theoretical, not so much law itself, but mm-hmm. other things, mm-hmm. human rights, all that kind of thing. Not right, you know, mm-hmm. but not the bread and butter mm-hmm. of a law practice. And that was his.
Was there opposition? I think you said last time that some of the established lawyers didn't quite see the need for a
yes. Well, that follows from what I was saying mm. that it was the country was not a and I'm glad you have brought that up because I can expand upon that a little more. The country was not used to having a university. This part of the world was not used to having a university. It was not used to having cultural things going mm. on. You just saw, you know, you just referred to the absence of theaters, of legitimate theater, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There was very little of that. There was no symphony orchestra until about 1920, when it was funded by a family here.
And there, of course, there was an absolutely massive industrial base in the form of logging and sawmilling.
Yeah. Hewers of wood and drawers of water.
Hewers of wood and drawers of water. And Burrard Inlet, this magnificent port.
Yes.
And the Fraser River was
yes. And very ugly it was.
And they were long on industry and
yes.
business and short on culture and education.
Yes. Yes, of course. It was a luxury. Mm. And the background of the people here would not be really drawn from the more sophisticated families in say Montreal or Toronto or New York mm-hmm. or particularly the New England states, mm-hmm. Nothing like that, and so the preachment of the Conservative Party was money. Nobody gave me a dime, so I don't see why I have to give anybody else a dime. That was the slogan of 1945 in the Conservative Party. Mm. And mm. you might ask me, what made me a little radicalized?
Mm. Yeah.
That happened. Mm. And so it was just exactly that. I think I did mention that in my memo to you, that the concern was that the School of Hard Knocks was the school they came up with. Mm-hmm. Most of people did. They
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own Scottish family, only the most brilliant were considered proper for a mm-hmm. university training.
Mm-hmm.
So not all of them went there.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out in the later generation, all of my cousins went to a university,
mm-hmm.
all in accordance with the times.
Mm-hmm.
But in many cases, the Scots were engineer, practical, all the rest of it. And the universities were fine. This, in a country of 5 million people that had 5 universities, mind
mm.
you.
Mm.
So there was a culture there for those things. Yes, they had mm. symphony orchestras. Yes, they had art galleries. They had all of this sort of thing. We didn't even have a decent art gallery until 1931.
Mm.
I was there at its opening.
Mm. So the infrastructure was, the cultural infrastructure was not yet in place.
And you know, that's, I meant to mention this to you, that it came to my thought the other day, I didn't know how to present it properly, that I found, as a kid, not a particularly bright kid, and not a terribly well-read kid, but my friends were, and the atmosphere was I was in, but I was very surprised that a lot of the lawyers hadn't read the latest novels and the latest stuff,
mm.
and that they were not interested in music.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being made fun of out at the first year law faculty when I was talking about Gil Kennedy, that's one of the mm. lecturers. Gil was interested in music. And we came across a case that was adjudicated in England by a judge called Vaughan Williams. And I asked in class Gilbert if he was any relation to Ralph Vaughan Williams. Oh, yes, he said he was a brother. That's interesting. What's this all about one of the class?
You
know? And it was known as arts versus the law student.
It sounds the word that springs to mind is, and here I'll betray my own background, but Philistine.
Yeah.
It sounds like a real kind of...
Well, it's easy to do this because if you look back on it, the lawyers that I was with, Mr. Hosey, for example, was interested in art. And he saw through some very fine pictures in the office from time to time. And in his own home, he had a wonderful Emily Carr.
Mm.
And he's from the prairies.
Mm.
But his wife, I think, probably had a lot to do with that. But he still was interested. But by and large, they were not. And the reason, of course, is to be perfectly, to be fair about it, is that they were darn busy.
Mm-hmm.
They were too busy for this. You know, I used to, I drew some immature amusement from Mr. McClorg, who would get into the elevator with me, and he'd have the Western Weekly reports in his hand. That's what he was going to read when he got home, the law reports.
Mm.
He wasn't going to do any reading about... you know, Steinbeck or anything like that.
Yeah.
No.
Mm.
And that's not because he wasn't. He was probably sent to a pretty good school,
mm-hmm.
and most of them were. Irwin Davis, who was the son of Ken Davis, was sent to Upper Canada College. So they were in the Toronto environment, which some people thought was not very cultural, but Toronto was.
So the sort of ethos was yeah. practical. It was
yeah.
sort of anti and
get to work. Get
yours.
To work.
Yeah.
And as I say, the city didn't have a symphony orchestra really until it had to be given by the few rich families that were around. I liked that kind of music, and I like to see it. I go and hear it. And, but not many other people did, and they had quite a time, as you could imagine, during the Depression. But they managed to rent the Orpheum, and they put on a couple of concerts a month, and a lot of it was volunteer too.
And the university itself had been threatened in about 1933 with closure.
Yes.
But itself.
Mr. Kidd, the president of the BC Electric Company, the predecessor to the Hydro. A lot of amusement is drawn from that, but then again, if you look at the province again and see that its origins were very humble, mm-hmm. and that Vancouver was only started in 1886.
Mm-hmm. So after the war, all these other UBC professionalized, it got the medical school and the law school,
yes.
and these other, I don't know when engineering came in, maybe it was a bit older.
No, it was there all along. I mean, all along from at least 1925, yes.
And I think forestry came in later.
Yes.
So was that part of I don't suppose it was specific to Vancouver or to BC. It was more of a...
Continent-wide. I'd say so.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from places like San Francisco, for example, young though it was, advanced very quickly. They had a full orchestra going and all this sorts of opera and so forth. I don't know why this was, mm-hmm. but San Francisco was a mecca for things that were like that, stage performances and so on. Los Angeles, of course, was the mother of the movies, not particularly noted for its great educational things.
Mm.
But it's hard to explain. It was a materialistic society. So was ours. We were very similar. And down there, baseball was the thing, of course,
mm-hmm.
still is. You get all that populist stuff. I think the main influence was from the big cities, from Montreal, from Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
It was from New York, I would say. For example, the Columbia Broadcasting Corporation broadcast the New York Philharmonic every Sunday.
Hmm.
And this was a great thing.
Hmm.
The Metropolitan Opera broadcast every Saturday.
Hmm.
The New York Philharmonic was done without a sponsor. The Metropolitan was sponsored by Texaco. And so it went. NBC had certain programs that were quite intellectual in their way. It wasn't the way it is now, Dan Cram on commercial television.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was no public broadcasting system either. And there was no real CBC here either.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, yes, it was... The intellectual was not relished much in North American society, but in certain areas, New York, Boston, places like that, yes, that's where it was coming from.
You'd think with the CPR choosing Vancouver as a terminus and this all red route you would think that, or I assume that the imperial connection. The British connection, the British Empire connection, would have rubbed off, would have brought some kind of veneer, or did it not? Did it just open the place up for commerce?
Oh, I think it did both. I think you're right in saying that. I think that if you're saying that, I think that not so much the CPR, because CPR was always in love with the CPR. I always remember when the CPR were giving up their local shipping lines to Victoria and so on through the Gulf, and the government was taking it over and so on, and there was a great contest going on about it. And people were asking the CPR what they thought they were going to do and so on, and the superintendent of shipping replied, The business of the CPR on boats is the CPR's business, not the public's. Memorable phrase.
That's quite a myopic view.
But the British, the British element. Victoria, of course, goes without saying, even to this day, thrives on the British, its British connections, of course, and its system of government, and its vice-regal appointments and so on, all are pretty well solidly in place. As to attitudes, I would say that the Depression had caused a lot of people to be cynical about everything, and about that too, and about the royal family as well. Not my father. Even though he was a Scot, he was very much, having been a veteran of the First World War, very British in his overlook, in his views. So it didn't, I formed my own views on these things. I felt non-committal about it. I was more impressed by the American. I can admit that. Why? Because the motion pictures. They were nearly all U.S. The British pictures were not very well developed. They got to be after the war, a bit more. The radio, the music, all that kind of thing, came from the States. The CBC was considered very stuffy. And in fact, they made a terrible mistake. In 1936, the Canadian Radio Commission, the one I was telling you about that had formed the radios across country in order to amuse the B-muse or amuse the first class passengers, which was the foundation of the Canadian Radio Commission, they thought that they should have a more developed one and they would model it after the BBC. And in 1936, they did just that, and they formulated everything the way the BBC did things, right down to the accents. And that went over like a lead balloon in most places. So there's not that that much engagement with things.
British. No. Doesn't sound like it.
It's a mix.
Yeah.
It's a real mix. It's hard to say. 50% of the Canadian population do not think it's necessary for us to have a royal connection. 50% think otherwise. No.
So the Depression was a local event. I mean, it was felt here, and it sounds like it was felt deeply, the economic downturn.
Well, it wasn't just a local event, Richard, as I've tried to explain. It was a continent-wide event. It was a worldwide event, in fact. It really was. It was so in Britain. I was over there in the mid-30s as a 14-year-old. All right, what does a 14-year-old know? He knows what his adults tell him, and he knows what he sees. And you could see the amount of distress there was in a big city like Glasgow. There are places you just wouldn't go anyway. They weren't safe. And it was very downcast. The slums of England also were remarkable. Slums of both Scotland and England. And they did establish the dole and that kind of thing. I think the estimate was there were always, between the wars, there was always about 2 million people unemployed. I don't know how significant the figure that really is, but it's significant to me in a country whose population I think at the time was estimated to be about 40 to 45 million, something like that. The U.S. was certainly afflicted, no question about that, and particularly in the southeast. But I would say that they did a little more, a good deal more than we did. They wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been for the energy that the Democratic government under FDR, Frederick Delano Roosevelt, had the determination to put through. We had a terrible time having to counteract the effects of the Supreme Court, and when he could appoint judges, as he could. Mm. They all had to be confirmed, of course. Mm. That's the one thing down there. You have to confirm your Supreme Court judges. We just get them appointed at the whim of the Prime Minister.
Well, we have to wind up in a minute, but it seems to me that we're up. 1914 will be next year, 2014, and we'll be hearing all about Vimy Ridge again and how Canadian identity was formed there. But it seems to me maybe the crucible of the Depression had as much to do with forming a mindset here. Or I mean, that's like an exam question. Discuss.
I wish I could. No. At least in terms of national unity, national feeling. I would have liked to have gotten onto that subject because in my post-retirement years, in addition to the activities that you may see in this little slip of paper I gave you, I was very busy doing things that I thought were important. They were probably weren't important, but they were interesting. And I was on a committee after the 1995 referendum from Quebec. You see, that's one of the things that detracts from national unity, of course, is this Quebec question. And when it came to the point where everybody thought by one vote, Quebec remained in Canada, how are you going to counteract the next time around? Mm. So they formed the Liberals got all very heated about it, as I think they should have. And a committee was formed of a national organization called the National Unity Committee to see what could be done to reinforce Canadian citizenship and Canadian unity and all the rest of it. And it was headed up by a man called McLaughlin. He was W.F. McLaughlin, I think of Kitchener Lang, one of our leading law firms in any event. And I was asked if I would like to join them, and I was very ready to do so. Our mayor, also a very fine fellow, Don Landscale, was on that committee, and he and I shared views on this. And we were ready to fight and ready to go. So we did quite a lot of things in terms of public education. Didn't do a lot of things. Tried to do a lot of things in terms of public education and so on with respect to Canadian history, about which very few Canadians know very much. I'm sure, do you agree with that statement?
I do, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. I remember going to a high school, for example, and at a meeting of the BC Society or of the BC Social Studies Teachers Association. And oh, what a lamentable experience that was. Mm. Maybe that will do for next day.
Yes, we should. We'll do this again. We have to, I think we should end this, Blair, because we've got the car and
of course we're
going to be in trouble if we don't get the car.
Of course, before you've got to go.
So thank you very